Chapter 18. David. The receptionist at Cheney, Baker, Smith & Lyons tells me that May is out of the office. I have never precisely understood what paralegals actually do every day, except, vaguely speaking, assist lawyers to do whatever lawyers do every day. I know laws, the Constitution, the Civil Rights Act, the 18th Amendment, like I know other mileposts of history. But beyond the billion or so jury trial vignettes I have seen on television, the daily practice of law is a mystery to me. Like medicine, like politics, it is all a kind of dark art to me, an impenetrable voodoo involving heavy drums and dances at night in the deep belly of the jungle on the other side of the river where I never, ever go. The receptionist asks if she can help me. I tell her I'm a friend of May Chang. I do not offer the more complicated truth of that friendship, because this is my one phone call, and I do not have the time to explain complicated truths about myself that even I do not understand. I tell her that I'm in jail. I need to speak to a lawyer, a criminal lawyer. God, I actually need a criminal lawyer. The receptionist puts me on hold, and I listen patiently to Guantanamera as she descends into the jungle for help. Suddenly, I'm speaking with a woman named Glenda Laveau. She does not actually tell me that she is from Brooklyn, but she may as well have.
"You say you're a friend of May?"
Glenda asks, as though confirming some sort of password. I confirm, and we speak briefly about my predicament.
"David, listen to me,"
she says.
"This is very important. Are you listening?"
"Yes, Glenda, I'm listening."
"Do not say anything to anybody about anything. Not a fucking word. Understand?"
"Yes," I say, thinking ashamedly of my open house party for Detective North.
"They really will use everything you say against you. I'll be there in an hour."
"Okay, thanks, Glenda."
"Forget about it. May's in a meeting, but I'll get someone to bring her up to speed."
There is something both hopeful and dreadful in my chest when she says this, but I keep it to myself and hang up the phone. I sit at a little table staring at the piss-yellow phone, hoping for a few extra minutes in this small empty room that is not a cell. But somewhere in the Westerville police station, a switchboard light has winked off, and they know my call is over. The door opens, and the officer who escorted me in jerks his head to escort me out. He does not take me to a jail cell, but to an interrogation room only 3 or 4 doors down the hallway. We pass a man in handcuffs, one officer on each arm. He is disheveled, a streak of dried blood beneath his left eye. We give each other looks of commiseration, and I realize that this is how it, the downslide, the process of personal corruption, all begins. I do not know this man or what he did. Assault, hit and run, maybe armed robbery. It doesn't matter. We are in the same boat. We share the same expression. I assume he has done something criminal, and he assumes the same about me. And yet these assumed transgressions are unimportant and instantly forgiven. We are both here, in the system. Busted. We are brothers. Poor, busted bastards. Closer to each other in this instant than to anyone else in the world. My actual innocence is far less powerful than the look of solidarity in his eyes, and I know that if my world really fell apart, if I had no one in my life to believe something better about me, something truer and more noble, I would ache for someone to look at me in this way that said, "I know who you are, brother." Even if I had to become a criminal to prove him right. That is how the downslide begins. And in identifying with this man, I have just taken the first step. It is a far worse fate to be alone in virtue than to be loved in depravity. If no one said that, someone should have. Passing within inches of one of the man's escorts, I cannot help but consider suddenly doubling back, pulling guns from holsters, tossing one to my brother in captivity, and shooting our way out. The two of us, guns blazing, out into the streets and into a new life that pays far greater emotional dividends than that of a single, sexually frustrated, underachieving, law-abiding public school teacher. But, of course, though I do size up the guns, I do not actually take advantage of this golden opportunity. Partly because guns secretly terrify me, and partly because I can still hear in my head the voice of the woman in the ambulance that wasn't really an ambulance. It's gotta get better sometime. I cling desperately to what is left of my optimism and answer her telepathically that, yes, it simply has to get better. The interrogation room is just a larger cousin of the telephone room. Bigger table, more chairs, no windows. Also missing is the large mirror, which I know is really a one-way window where attractive cops and prosecutors listen to everything I say. I am left to imagine attractive cops and prosecutors pressing their ears to the other side of the wall. Have a seat, Dave. It's Detective North, leaning up against the far wall. I sit, but don't look at him. Did you make your call? I say nothing. Look, Dave, he says, coming over to lean on the table. I gotta know where we go from here. Are we gonna talk? Do you have a lawyer? Is he coming over? If not... I have a lawyer, I snap at him. She's on her way. Good. So maybe we can talk when she gets here. Who's your lawyer? Glenda. I've already forgotten her name. Glenda something. Glenda Laveau? Yeah. Chaney Baker somebody and somebody? Yeah. Terrific. Detective North is not happy. We'll talk when she gets here, he says, and leaves the room, locking the door behind him. I wait. I spend most of my time imagining how the sequential revelations of my arrest, conviction, and incarceration will play out over the faces of my parents, my brother, my sister, and May. Invariably, their faces melt like warm wax from shock to concern to disappointment, because ultimately, this will all boil down to my own bad judgment. And there are always consequences to bad judgment, aren't there, David? I'm sitting at the table, waiting. Sitting at the table, listening. I am 17 years old, and I'm sitting at the table in the dining room. My father is sitting across from me, my mother pacing behind him, wanting to express the emotion he will not express and never quite does. But she is holding her tongue, rubbing her enormous 7-month belly in a deliberate clockwise motion, letting him do the talking. Tilly is crouching on the stairs off the living room. I can see her in the background. They do not know she is there, believing she is in her room where she has been banished. If they find her there, listening on the stairs, there will be trouble. But this is the dawning of the days in which Tilly always won, beating my father down, indomitable in the wars of attrition for control. We are hardwired to care, and to care desperately what our parents think of us, and this concern lies at the very heart of parental authority. Tilly had stopped recognizing that authority, or at least had begun fighting it with all of her might, by the time she was 10. I, on the other hand, have never stopped recognizing my parents' claim to judge me. The Van Susterens have been good friends to me and your mother for many years, David, he is telling me, his voice calm and controlled, but controlled like something that must be controlled, lest there be some dreaded emotional rupture. Heinrich is a longtime client of my bank. Inga brokered the sale of this house. I hope you can understand that breaking into their home...
I didn't break into her home...
You will let me finish and you will not interrupt. Do you understand?
Yes.
I hope you can understand that breaking into their home has caused a lot of damage. The least of that damage, David, is to the fish on the floor and the carpet, which is bad enough. The real damage is to trust. Our trust in you. Their trust in us and you and Tilly. You have seriously angered friends of ours, and you have greatly embarrassed us. They could press charges and have you arrested. You understand that?
Yes.
They thought they'd been burgled or vandalized. I went over there tonight and looked at the damage with Heinrich and the police. That was a 20-gallon saltwater tank. They lost all their fish, which Inga had been collecting for years.
Years, David,
adds my mother.
She's collected them from everywhere.
Okay, Susan, he tells her. Okay, let me just...
Okay, sorry.
The clockwise caress has now become a frenetic polishing, wax-on, wax-off sort of motion. Thank you, says my father, turning away from her. The carpet is ruined. The tank is shattered. The coffee table is shattered. Glass everywhere.
It was an accident, Dad. Tilly didn't see...
They called the police, David. The police showed up. The police conducted an investigation. I mean, you get all of that, don't you?
I do now. I didn't then, but I do now. I do.
And you understand that if the Van Susterens were so inclined, they could sue me and your mother for damage to their home?
Yes.
They have assured me that they are not going to do either of those things.
That's nice of them, Dad. I'm...
Yes, David. It is nice of them. They're nice people. They don't deserve this.
No, they don't. I wasn't trying to... Sorry.
You understand that every dollar of damage to that place is coming out of your pocket? However long it takes. Every dollar.
Dad, I didn't even go in. Tilly...
David, I don't want to hear it. He slaps the table with his palm so hard everybody jumps. His face is red with genuine anger. I do not want to hear that from you. The fact that you put your little sister up to this is despicable. Despicable. I mean, that really burns me up. Tilly is 10. Your mother plucked a shard of glass out of her forehead. She could have been blinded. She's a little girl with all the judgment of a houseplant. She's 10.
I'm not a little girl.
My sister is shrieking from the staircase, and for a moment my parents are terrified at the sudden explosion of sound from behind them.
You leave him alone! I wanted to go in! I wanted to!
She is wearing her blue rainbow nightie, and her white legs hanging off the staircase flow into the same pure feet that none of us had been able to resist tickling when she was just a little younger. Her hair is pulled back from her face in a ponytail, and her eyes are wet and green and lovely. She has a small bandage on her forehead. Her countenance is one of red-cheeked, resolute fury. She is pointing directly, condemningly at my father. It is the first time I can remember envying my sister's strength.
I wanted to!
Tilly!
You leave him alone!
Damn it, Tilly, you get in that room like I told you, or I will tan that hide, but good. Right now! Susan, will you please just...
Leave him alone! He didn't do anything to that bitch!
My mother, surprisingly agile for her condition, is all over her, and there is crying and shrieking and cussing that recede up the stairs like a tornado full of barnyard animals being sucked back up into the clouds. My father closes his eyes for a second. She's 10, he says. She's a child. You're almost 17. You'll be a junior in high school. You have a job. Thinking about college, you're supposed to be responsible. When you and Tilly are together, out in the world, out in the neighborhood, you are responsible for her. Got it? You are responsible. You should know better than to get your little sister to break into someone's home for a stupid football.
It's signed by Dan Marino, and it doesn't even belong to me. It belongs to Peter.
David, I don't care if it was signed by the Pope and belongs to President George H.W. Bush. It was rotten judgment.
Heinrich wouldn't give it back. Every time it goes in their yard, they keep it. And this time I threw it, Dad. It was my bad pass. I'm responsible for that ball. What? I am. Peter will hardly even talk to me.
Did you think of just asking for it?
Peter's asked Mr. Van Susteren for it like 10 times. I've asked like 5 times. Like every day for 2 weeks.
So it's okay to send your 10-year-old sister in through the basement window?
No.
He leans back in the dining room chair. His chair, with the creak of distressed oak that I associate with my father's contemplation and with the weight of words yet unspoken. He drinks from his glass of wine and looks at me, sizing up the lesson for the proper flourish. I torture my leather bracelet with a finger, waiting. Trust is a precious thing, David. Maybe one of the most important things. You have to guard it with your life. Once you lose it, well, it doesn't come back easily. What do you think would happen to me if, as a banker, I just decided to treat other people's money as if it were my own? If I just abused people's trust? Well, okay, shrug your shoulders if you want. But I think you get my drift here. Don't you?
Yes.
You know that there are always consequences to the things we do, even if we don't specifically intend those consequences. There are always consequences. That's why we have to exercise judgment. Good judgment, David. And you certainly have shown none of that today. I would have hoped that getting tossed on your ear out of the Vanguard Academy would have taught you something about responsibility and consequences. Have you already forgotten that humiliatingly close brush with criminal prosecution?
No, sir.
Really? I'm beginning to think the humiliation was all mine.
No, sir.
Well, you had better shape up, or I promise you that one day you will end up sitting in a police station, and when that day comes, you will wish.
The door unlocks and opens. I jerk my head up to see Detective North, followed by a heavy-set, well-dressed woman, 50 or so, carrying a legal pad and a pen. She is walking beneath a pile of jet-black hair the size and shape of a small wedding cake. Half a dozen thin corkscrew tendrils escape in all directions, bouncing as she walks, almost orbiting her head like some sort of mobile. Her lipstick makes it to the table well before she does, a bright coral pink, to match the nails. North closes the door and straddles a chair at the head of the table. A large, dry marker board is on the wall behind him. Someone has written in quick, sloppy green letters the words, breathalyzer, and RST equals roadside sobriety test. Over the green letters, at a diagonal, is the red, thick-lettered word, jail. North opens a manila folder and clicks a ballpoint pen as he reads. Glenda Laveau drops her pad on the table with a slap.
Yeah, right, she says to North. Dream on, eager beaver. I talk to my client first. You're not invited.
Detective North looks at her, surprised at first, then gives his pen another click and sighs, standing up.
You've got 15 minutes, and then I'd like some answers.
He is looking directly at Glenda, and she back at him.
Out, tough guy!
She jerks her thumb toward the door, and North leaves us alone. Glenda writes something on her pad and then looks at me.
Okay, let's have it. Give me the whole story, beginning to end. And know this, David.
She points a powerful, pink-tipped finger at my face.
You lie to me one fucking time, and I will drop you like a hot rock. We on the same page?
Yeah, got it.
I'm easily more afraid of Glenda Laveau than I am of Detective North. I tell her the story. I tell her everything. Shep, the come-on at the bar, the girls, the dance, the argument, the drugs, the suspension, the interview with Detective North, the desecrated civic. I leave out nothing except the glass of water and the tour of my home that I so kindly provided to Detective North. I omit these details because I am convinced they are irrelevant, and because in the few seconds I have known her, I have come to suspect that Glenda Laveau is intolerant of stupidity. Perhaps violently so. When I'm done, she continues scribbling for a good 2 minutes before looking at me again. Her eyes are huge and frosted, like candied oysters.
Is that it? She asks.
There is an undisguised incredulity in her voice.
That's it.
I mean, literally, there's nothing else.
That's it.
She's been missing for, like, what, 3 days?
2.
Another scribble as she shakes her head.
Fucking cops. Let's get this dick in here. And listen to me, David. I'm gonna take care of you, okay? Like you are my own boy. My own flesh and blood. We're gonna get you out of this. but I don't want you to say another fucking word to these guys. You understand?
Yes, I understand. Glenda charges out of the room and is back in seconds with Detective North in tow. He looks at me over her shoulder as he closes the door.
Are we ready to talk, Dave?
North sits and drops a file on the table. He folds his arms over his massive chest and pushes his weight into the back legs of the chair, the buttons on his shirt straining.
He's not breathing another fucking word, Chuck.
That's too bad, Counsel.
Are you holding him?
Depends.
On?
On whether he cooperates and tells us the truth.
What, and you think he hasn't?
I know he hasn't. Every other word out of this man's mouth is a lie.
Bullshit.
Suit yourself.
He turns to me. Ever spent any time in jail, Dave?
I've told you everything I know. I haven't lied about any...
Glenda Laveau is glowering at me sideways. One of her black corkscrew tendrils preternaturally uncoils in my direction. I cross my own arms in a gesture by which I intend to show indignation, but which I know is closer to petulance. I wish my chest were bigger.
You've got nothing, Chuck.
Counsel, I've got a missing girl.
A missing girl. She's been gone 2 fucking days. She's off smoking dope and balling her boyfriend. She'll be back.
I got her teacher, Mr. Johns, here, who has her purse loaded with drugs stuffed under the front seat of his car, none of which he bothered to tell me about.
1/2 ounce of grass is hardly loaded with drugs.
It was 2 full ounces, Counsel. That was on top of 6 tabs of ecstasy and a vial of seriously bad coke.
What?
I cannot help myself. Glenda slams her hand down so hard on the table that a small yelp escapes my throat. Detective North, Chuck, tries not to laugh.
I don't give a fuck what's in the purse. I'll suppress that shit in nothing flat.
I doubt that.
Illegal search and you know it. You want to wipe your ass with the 4th Amendment? Be my guest. But you got nothing to use.
I got witnesses who saw them dancing.
So?
I got witnesses who saw them arguing.
So?
I got witnesses who saw them kissing.
Glenda does not say so. But if she is rattled, for I am fucking rattled, she doesn't show it. Instead, she snorts in disgust and shakes her head. My mouth has fallen open, and so I close it.
I got witnesses who say Brittany thought he was cute, and that Brittany and Mr. Johns, her oh-so-cute teacher here, were headed out to do some drugs. I'm guessing the very drugs found in his possession. If nothing else, I got Mr. Johns here dead to rights on possession of narcotics.
The drugs aren't his and you know it.
I got witnesses who say Mr. Johns was coming on pretty strong and bringing her drinks and that Brittany was all a flutter because Mr. Johns was taking her home for the night and a little extra credit. And I got witnesses who saw them leave Billy Rocks together. I've got someone who thinks our man here is a rapist and has chosen to express that opinion all over the side of his car.
My stomach goes into sickening spasms, and I want to vomit. The blood seems to be draining from my head.
Looking a little green there, Dave, he says. Want some water?
I hold up my hand, waving him off.
Are you sure? You gave me water. Least I can do is return the favor.
I shake my head again. Glenda is shaking her head. At me this time.
Still think I got nothing, Counsel?
He says to Glenda.
You got dick.
It's enough to lock him up.
But not enough to keep him. You got no victim, no crime, and no evidence that is not either irrelevant, inadmissible hearsay, or illegally seized. He'll be out in the morning and you'll have wasted everybody's time. Judges love that sort of shit, Chuck. So do I, because it makes me look good. Nothing like getting off on the right foot.
Detective North opens his file and leafs through some papers. He closes it and looks at me, clicking his pen. He's giving me that, it's your choice, take your chances, pay the consequences look, like he is completely indifferent to whether or not I speak another word. Since I know he is not, in fact, indifferent, I know his look is a cheap manipulation, a tactic. I tell myself that I should be heartened that Detective North thinks he needs tactics. but I am not persuaded that there is any reason to feel heartened about anything. The word jail glowing over his shoulder is like a branding iron. Up to you, Dave. It's your ass, man. You want to tell what happened after you and Brittany Klein left Billy Rocks? I know better than to look at Glenda Laveau. I know that if I so much as clear my throat, she will break the table with her hand. So I just look at him, trying to stare him down. He is much better at this than I am. But I am thinking that Tilly could break him. I know there's pressure on this one, Chuck, says Glenda, almost sympathetically. Departmentally and personally, but you're looking in the wrong place. I got him on possession alone, counsel. Is that what this is? A narcotics bust? I thought you were looking for a girl. The shit's not his. He confiscated from this kid what he thought was a makeup bag with a couple of joints, and then he stuffed it in the car that you then illegally searched. I didn't search anything without your client's consent. Hell, you didn't. This is nonsense, Chuck. Don't you have better things to do? Detective North clicks his pen and stands up, towering above the table. When my eyes finally reach his, he shrugs. Okay, suit yourself, Dave. I'm trying to bend for you here. I just want to find out what happened to this kid. I know you understand that. It's not personal between us. I know you understand that, too. But you're not helping me much here. Maybe what your lawyer here says about you is true. Maybe it's not. I don't know. That's why I investigate things. That's why I need your cooperation. But it looks like that's not going to happen. So let me go check with a couple of folks, cash in a few chips, and see what I can do, okay? No promises. You guys sit here for a minute. I'll be back in a couple. When he is gone, Glenda Laveau rolls her eyes. Asshole! I'm reasonably sure she is referring to Detective North.
Gave him some water, did you?
Yeah, sorry, I...
Now I'm going to assume that you gave him a drink from your fucking garden hose out on the fucking lawn, because I know you would have told me if you'd actually invited that shithead into your home. That would make you about as stupid as you are cute. And you are cute.
I must look as bad as I feel. Glenda looks at me for a moment, then softens and smiles for the first time.
Relax, David. You're going to sleep in your own bed tonight.
Really?
Yeah, they can't keep you in long even if they want it. Besides, they want to follow you around a while. The game is to shake you up so that you'll go check on the body, or revisit the crime scene, or make a special trip to the dump, or try to keep all of your accomplices quiet. Until they find this kid, you're no good to them in jail.
So they're gonna, what, tail me?
Yep, everywhere you go. You better live clean, boy. Leave the body where it is for now and burn any used condoms you've got lying around.
I have no response. A surge of adrenaline organizes itself for imminent protest.
Relax, Dave. I'm just fucking with you.
Relax, relax, take a breath. So, you like teaching high school? Yeah, I guess. It has its moments.
Good for you, good for you. I bet that takes patience teaching kids. Patience with kids is one fucking thing I don't have, you know? I love them, but keep them the fuck away from me. Hey, I hear you're related to,
She snaps her fingers repeatedly, looking for a name. Tilly?
Yeah, that's the one.
Sister.
No shit.
True.
Ooh-wee. I bet that's a trip and a half. Your poor mother.
Well, don't believe every... Detective North is back. He leaves the door open. Okay, Dave. I'm gonna let you go home. We're not gonna charge you with anything at this point. We're gonna let the DA kick that one around a little. No promises. It's out of my hands at this point. Let's cross our fingers that Brittany shows up healthy very soon with an explanation that does not involve a history teacher.
We're not worried, says Glenda. Whatever the explanation is has nothing to do with my client.
She's got a violin recital this weekend. She's been preparing all summer. If she's not back by then, something's very wrong, and we'll be turning up the heat.
So maybe it's performance anxiety. Maybe she's just hiding, Chuck.
Not this kid. She's fearless, dedicated to her music, and very, very talented. Don't leave town, Dave. Give me a call. Or I guess I should say, have your lawyer here give me a call if you hear anything at all about Brittany.
Count on it, says Glenda, slapping her pad on the table and standing up. Okay, I got another thing across town. Let's get a move on, David.
I am up and moving and can hardly believe I'm free. My legs are weak with muscle tension. Oh, and Dave. I turn at the door. Shit, this is it. The Columbo moment that somewhere deep in my psyche I have anticipated. Glenda Laveau is already halfway down the hall, almost to the tiny telephone room, swinging her hips into passing cops like a wrecking ball. I turn back to Detective North, trying to brace myself. Yeah? Don't go painting over that car of yours until we can get a unit out to your place to take some pictures and a sample of the paint. When will that be exactly? Few days at the latest. We'll let you know. So you're gonna call first, or? It's Glenda, from half a football field away.
What did I fucking tell you?
It is only after I shake hands with Glenda and watch her charging off toward the parking garage that I see May. She is leaning against her car, parked on the street near the corner. Black skirt, sheer white blouse, perfect face. The hair. She is of mixed descent, Chinese, Hawaiian, and Mexican, taking the best of each and blending them into something that is simply unfair. She looks like a magazine ad for the Saab Turbo. Saab Turbo, dangerous curves ahead. Or maybe, Saab Turbo, life's a bitch. Your bitch. Or maybe just, Saab means never having to say you're sorry. She waves, and I wave back with surprising ease, as though I had last seen her a few hours earlier. I give her a hug, uncertainly, but she reciprocates pleasantly enough.
Sounds like you're in a little trouble.
Appears that way.
What the hell is going on, Dave?
A big misunderstanding and some really bad judgment. They think I've done something to one of my students.
What? Really? You mean like you're having sex with...
No. Yes. I mean, no, but they think so, and she's missing. Look, it's a long story, and I just don't have it in me to go through it again. I called because I needed a lawyer.
Yeah, Glenda left me a message. I came over as soon as I could. Rob wanted me to attend this client meeting, and it went on forever, but anyway. Shit, Dave. So what's... You're not in jail, right?
How is Rob, anyway?
Dave.
She closes her eyes and runs her fingers through her hair, which is what she does whenever she wants to run me through with something sharp and serrated. I am a jerk, and I instantly regret the question. All of my pre-arrest resolutions about forgiving and forgetting and lightening up and loving the imperfection of life seem so far away.
Do you really want to get right back into that?
No, I don't, sorry. Glenda's a real piece of work, but she is good. I just work the civil side, so I don't really, you know, work with her, but she's respected around the firm. I'll bet. Look, I don't suppose you could give me a lift? She hesitates. I can see her trying to figure out where this will lead. You're probably busy. I can just...
Where's your car?
I hitched a ride in a squad car on the way over.
Hey, I can just...
Don't be silly. Hop in. I'm heading toward the curb when Detective North emerges from the entrance to the police station. He is patting his pockets for his keys, but eventually looks up. I can see the recognition on his face, and then the realization that I am looking back. He lingers over May for a minute and salutes. I ignore him.
I know that guy, says May, as I am in and buckling up. Who is he? Is he a cop? What? You know him? He's the cop that brought me in.
You know him?
Oh, shit. She looks at me, wide-eyed.
Dave, he bought me a drink last night.
He...
Where? Wildcats. He was... He said he knew you. He said...
Oh, shit, Dave. He said he used to teach at Wilson. I thought it was like this big coincidence. We laughed about what a small world it is.
Oh, shit. Shit, Dave. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. What an idiot. But at that point, I had no idea you were even in trouble.
I'm torn between sickness at the thought that North has been secretly insinuating himself into my life and a woozy warmth at the sound of May's contrition and the feel of her slender fingers grasping my shoulder. She smells like soap and flowers.
What did you tell him?
I don't really... It just wasn't significant at the time. Shit, let's see. I told him that we used to date. We both agreed that you were a really great guy and really smart.
He said he thought you were a really great teacher. Oh, he said you were a really great teacher because you spent a lot of quality time with your students. Shit, Dave, he was fishing. He asked if I knew one of them.
Brittany Klein?
Yes. Is that her? Is that the girl?
Yeah. What else?
Nothing, really. I don't know. He asked if we were still together, and when I saw you last, I thought he was just hitting on me.
What did you tell him?
Oh, I don't know. That's about when Brenda showed up and he took off. Said he had a softball game. Man, I can't believe he was pumping me for information.
May starts the turbo and pulls away. I know that she is lying, that she remembers precisely what she told Inspector Javert, that we have now been done easily for 6 weeks, that I am ancient history, that she is available. I know now that is why North was asking me questions about her. I know that among the many lies North thinks I have told him is the actual lie that May and I are living together, madly in love and destined to be married. Suddenly, I can see that I am exactly the type of person to be taking out my frustrations on a starry-eyed student. May hits the freeway and slips the car into fifth, accelerating sharply. I can see her legs working the pedals. She has this thing against wearing heels and driving a stick, so her shoes are off, her left foot arching off the clutch, and her right pushing in the gas. Two columns of glossy flesh emerge from the darkness beneath the steering column and disappear into the darkness of her skirt.
Saab Turbo, we're simply out of your league.
For a moment, I'm not worried about felonies or violent showers in the pen. I'm temporarily transfixed by the immediacy of May's erotic appeal. In spite of all my longing reminiscence, night after night after night, I had forgotten. It feels like months, even years, since I have smelled her, touched her, looked at her from this distance. I want to reach over and yank the wheel, pulling the car onto the shoulder, forcing her to stop, reclining the seat. I cannot believe that I have ever been so fortunate as to be in a relationship, a romantic, sexual relationship with this, and yet so incredibly stupid as to provoke its destruction. No, that's not true. It is not destroyed. It is not. A corrective course is not destruction. We're still building an understanding. She's here, isn't she? In my time of need, she is here, sitting right over fucking there. But Detective North is still close by. I can feel him, following my thoughts even now, burrowing into my brain and twisting the prurient thoughts of an honest, red-blooded man into something far more weak and pathetic. I cannot help but wonder if May thought he was attractive, if she and Brenda spent the first 15 minutes of their night at Wildcats talking in mirthful whispers about what they would like to do with him. She asks questions as she drives. I end up telling the story all over again, relishing her attention and hating myself for it. Hating that it takes the prospect of a violent felony conviction to get her attention. And hating that, in just the right light, it is all worth it. I'm relieved when she is quiet and, at the same time, desperate for some sign that she is still there, connected, interested. concerned.
We arrive at the place that used to be ours, although, truth be told, she never did give up her own place in Bellevue.
When she left, everything, including the wall clock, fit into one suitcase. But just the same, I thought of it as our place.
She cuts the engine and climbs out, and for a second, I feel the rising hope that she wants to come inside,
that rote memory will pull her back in, and that the surroundings will unlock memories of forgotten fondness.
But that's not why she has climbed out. She wants to see the rapist car.
Honda Civic, so much less than your typical sob story.
Oh my God, David, that's terrible. And you've been driving around this way?
Probably just today, but who knows how long it's been there. My neighbor's circular saw winds its way through a sheet of plywood.
Still at it, huh? She says, looking behind her at the sound. Every night.
She laughs and shakes her head, reappraising the Civic.
You want to come inside, May? Just for a while?
Dave.
Just dinner. Look, we'll call Pink Pagoda. We can talk. It would be nice just to have, you know, someone to talk to.
She looks at me, motionless, unblinking, as though God has hit the pause button, and I remember painfully these pregnant pauses in our more strained relations. Pauses suggesting some silent audit of secret considerations. Pauses that betoken unpredictable changes in direction. When she blinks, she looks again for a moment at the angry red epithet, emblazoned across the side of my car. Her hand moves to her lips, and I realize she is trying to stifle a laugh. It escapes, anyway.
I'm sorry,
she says, sweetly.
It's not funny, it's not, it's just so ridiculous.
Thank you, I say, and head for the door. At first, it is awful. Awful to see her so polite, so respectful in my home, in which she once roamed so freely. Awful to see her wait to be invited from the doorway into the hall, into the kitchen, into the living room, where she eventually sits and crosses her legs and drinks her wine. I know she's not nervous or polite, or even just naturally inclined to be deferential where I am concerned. She isn't any of these things, and never has been. She is making a point, drawing a boundary. I read her loud and clear, and I hate it. But I am in control of myself now. I am, incredibly, relaxed and casual and, for all appearances, unconcerned with whatever boundary she wishes to draw. We spend some more time talking about Brittany Klein and my suspension and what we think will happen next, which is, we resolve, a lot of waiting around for Brittany to resurface and for everyone to realize they have been jumping to foolish conclusions. Until that happens, May's advice is the same as Shep's. Keep my mind off the situation. Try not to sweat what I can't control. Catch up on reading. Start working out again. Paid time off. I confess to her that I am slightly intimidated by Glenda Laveau, and she thinks this is funny. Partly, I assume, because I am so charmingly self-deprecating about it. She tells me that Glenda is single and has had notorious affairs with two different associates in the office. I tell her that I am not intimidated sexually so much as physically, by the fear that she will one day be unable to resist beating the crap out of me. May laughs harder, saying that each of Glenda's playthings eventually told stories of bruises and pulled muscles and battered egos. We conclude that, sex or no sex, I am destined to have the shit kicked out of me by Glenda Laveau. At full volume, May's laugh has a honking nasal quality that I've never much liked. It is too jarring and liltless for my taste. Too at odds with the sleek lines of her form. I don't care. May is laughing in my living room. I can feel the evening beginning to soften. By the time the food arrives, the wine has begun to put an end to the mutual awkwardness, and we are both more authentic and comfortable in each other's company. once she ventures to the refrigerator and helps herself to a bottle of soy sauce and a handful of grapes. She does not ask. She just does it. And this makes me feel good. Like I have reintroduced an endangered species back into its native habitat, and it is showing all the signs of successful readaptation. As though she is Willy the Orca, back in the ocean and chasing fish on her own. Only with better legs. She tells me that Cheney Baker Smith & Lyons is considering opening an office in Cleveland and that Rob Lyons, son of the great Parker Lyons, is pushing for it, mostly because of issues he is having with several of the other partners. It's a profit distribution thing, she explains, without explaining. Rob really wants me to come with him to open the Cleveland office, but I really like it where I am. She speaks freely as though Rob's name and what Rob wants from her and what she thinks about Rob and why Rob requires so much after-hours attention has never spoiled conversation over dinner. As though my reaction to the vague and undefined threat of Rob was not the very particular straw that broke the camel's back. She is testing me, and I pass with flying colors, encouraging her to look at the bigger picture. You could always give Cleveland a try. You'd probably be lead paralegal out there, probably more money. If you hate it, then it's back to Columbus. Rob said he'd make it worth my while, but I don't know. I'm still thinking about it. He can be kind of an overbearing jerk sometimes. My, how the mighty hath fallen. Rob, faultless, flawless, well-meaning, misunderstood, get off his back, you jealous prick, Rob, is now kind of an overbearing jerk. But I make no effort to actually collect any of these points. Maybe the answer is in the fortune cookie, I say, holding one cookie in each hand behind my back. Left or right? It is a game we used to play, and now I am testing her. She leans across the couch, kissing me softly on the right cheek, brushing my left with the tips of her fingers. I blush and present her choice. Hard decisions make for good opportunities, she reads, then laughing, wide-eyed, as though I have managed some flawless parlor conjuring. Well, isn't that right on the money? Does that mean I go to Cleveland? Maybe, if you're foolish enough to organize your life by a fortune cookie. Hey, she swats me in the arm. It was your idea. Open yours. Let's see it. She divvies the rest of the wine and drinks deeply as I break the thing open. Identity is but the mask of the soul worn in the prison of the self. We both look into emptiness for a moment. What is that supposed to mean? She asks. Beats me, but I object to the word prison in any and every context at the moment. I can't eat this now. I'm sure it's bad luck. Oh, come on, you big baby. Here, I'll eat it. I feed her the broken shell in bits and crumbs, each bite requiring that the flesh of her lips encase the tips of my fingers. At the last of it, she is sucking gently and using her tongue to pry them open. It is a game, but a game rapidly losing its humor. I can feel that rising sense of urgency and the seriousness I associate with high-stake endeavors and things that I want just a little too much to be either healthy or realistic. She smells like soy sauce and spicy oil and pikake, and her breath is on my face like a wet cloud. She kisses me, and my hands find her clumsily, our torsos cruelly twisted to face each other on my sagging couch, our legs splayed beneath an array of pink pagoda boxes scattered across the long, low antique table my mother could no longer stand in her living room. The moment is so charged, so beyond what I expected out of this day, that I do not close my eyes, which wander around the room behind her as if lost or confused, seeing but not seeing. It is a kind of shock, I think, an unwillingness to believe in what might still somehow be open to interpretation. May rolls my lower lip between her teeth, and I fumble vainly at her buttons. I have missed you a little, you know, she says to me in a low groan. Whatever I am about to say, surely something banal about absence making hearts fonder, whatever it was, never makes it out. The playful lip-nibbling mushrooms into a full-out mashing of flesh that prevents intelligible speech. The rest of my body responds as expected, but my eyes remain open, meandering like insomniacs as the world dreams. I am staring across the silken curtained plain of May's hair at the dark glass eye of the television. The eye stares back at the rapidly developing situation on my couch. It asks silently, judgmentally, if this moment is really all I had hoped it would be. If my life is really so empty as to be utterly transformed by this, whatever this was. A quickie? Reconciliation? Nostalgia? Sympathy? Wine? The television has all the answers, but it ain't talking. Above the television is the framed poster of Nelson Mandela. It consists of two large photos, one stacked atop the other. In the top photo, he is wearing a white shirt buttoned to the neck, looking contemplatively out of the bars of a jail cell across an overexposed landscape. In the bottom photo, he is older, standing behind a dirty green Jeep, laughing uproariously as he holds a young white girl in his arms, pointing at a pride of lions lounging lazily in the shade of a distant acacia. Separating the two photos are Mandela's words. There is no easy walk to freedom. Anywhere. The poster had been left in the closet by the guy from whom I, and by I mean my father, purchased the condo. May had retrieved it one day, insisting that it replace my Bob Marley poster, which had been on the wall when she moved in and which she strangely hated. I have since come to believe that her distaste was due more to her antipathy for reggae in general than the psychedelic tie-dye motif of the poster. It is also possible that she associates Bob Marley with marijuana and with all the cultural and political identity that, along with the weed itself, she takes a certain pride in rejecting. Not that I have ever scored enough pot as an adult to really present her with much of an opportunity. At Tulane, long before May, we all but packed our pillows with the stuff, smoking brazenly at Friday night toke parties. The tokes, we called them. Our chance to thumb our noses at convention and to rebel against the man. Except that the man at the time was William Jefferson Clinton, and true rebellion would have meant low-carb health food and faith-based monogamy. Which is asking a little too much of college kids just looking for a way to dress up a cheap loss of coherence. We marveled at how easy it must have been to take Nancy Reagan for granted until she was no longer around to give simple reefer madness some real political gravitas. Out of college, my fond relationship with cannabis hit the skids. I knew how to smoke it, but I never knew how to find it, the good stuff, or for that matter, how to pay for it. On the rare occasions that I have had any to offer, I have tried mightily to expand May's horizons. But invariably, her perfect conservative little nose wrinkles in opposition, as though I have asked whether she would consider growing out her pit hair, or conserving wetlands, or trying a three-way with Noam Chomsky and Ted Kennedy. We have learned from painful experience not to even discuss the issue of medical marijuana. In the last round on that subject, May found something unfairly accusatory about my tone and about my totally irrelevant stoned-is-stoned observations concerning her weekly craving for tumblers of neon-colored grain alcohol. In any case, there was never really any doubt about the Marley poster coming off the wall. When May left, I frequently considered replacing Mandela with Marley, reestablishing dominion over my own home. But I could never take the Mandela poster down. On good days, there is something so inspiring, so optimistic about the photographic juxtaposition, the man confined and the man unbroken, that I cannot bring myself to put him in the closet. On bad days, when the little cannibals have devoured me to a nub and I seriously question my ability to teach anybody anything, there is something irresistibly dark and satisfying. Something comically vengeful at the idea that Nelson Mandela is about to swing this blonde kid by the ankles into a heap of bored and hungry lions. Nelson laughs. I laugh, the poster stays. May stands, unfastening as she rises what I cannot seem to unfasten. She stands over me, and I look up, obeisante, my face now the level of her waist. I run my fingers along the backs of her legs and up to the belfry of her skirt, slipping beneath the elastic. She drops her blouse in my lap, turns, and heads for the hallway and the bedroom beyond, unfastening and unclipping and unzipping as she moves out of sight. I am alone on the couch, listening to her bare footsteps and to the groaning springs of my bed. Jagged metal teeth rip through another sheet of plywood. Something large splinters and falls to concrete. I find myself wondering if my neighbor is exercising some sexual or emotional frustration. He can't be happy, I think. He can't be satisfied. Every night with the saw. He can't be. I stand, unbuttoning my shirt, feeling a surge of pent-up sexual desire, the power of which is matched only by an undeniable ambivalence for what is about to happen. I cannot reconcile these feelings, and so I block them out. Both of them. Because they are inseparably intertwined, the desire and the ambivalence, and I do not have a saw. It is very much the same as it always was. The smell of her skin is the same, the feel of her fingers. We work through the same tight routine of acts from a pornographic circus. Roughly the same order and duration. There is a low-voltage current that sews them all together like a tough strand of electric thread. I know this is simply the work of abstinence, a neural reunion of lost sensations, but I don't care. If there is any benefit to deprivation, then this has to be it, and I gladly put the electricity to good use. Not everything, however, is the same. Her exclamations have changed. What was once usually a simple, "Yes, yes, oh God, David, right there, yes," or simply, oh God," had now become less personal, less theistic, more aggressive. "Fuck me, Dave, give it to me, harder, give me your cock, Dave, oh, fuck yeah, harder." It is theater. Bad theater. Exciting because it is different. Disturbing because it is different. I cannot help but think that this small and ridiculous change is a learned accommodation to another's preference. Rob Lyons? Is this what Rob likes? I am renewing my skepticism that their relationship is, or ever was, strictly business. Old jealousies threaten my erection. I shake them loose and do as she commands. "Fuck me harder, Dave. Fucking fuck me harder, Dave. Give it to me raw, you filthy fuck." I realize that she has evolved, devolved, changed, and that she has been changing continuously since she moved out, and that she has always been changing since before I met her. I have simply intersected this arc of change at specific points in her life and cannot help but compare snapshots along the traverse. I try to imagine the topography of my own developmental arc, and can conjure only a flat line. To her, I must be exactly the same as always. Static. This bothers me beyond all reason. I am fighting a rising tide of inadequacy and anger. At her. At myself. At the buzzsaw next door that will not stop. I am overcome with the need to be different and unpredictable and someone who, if you were not paying rapt attention every second, might change into someone entirely different, leaving you behind in the dust with your old, useless expectations. Each role with me might be different than the last. I reach around her as her hips are thrusting violently into my groin and slap her on the ass. Hard. "Ow! What the fuck?" Then again, on the opposite cheek, this time licking the tips of my fingers first for a little sting. "David, ow!" Her face is flushed and angry and confused and hanging down only inches from my own, so close she is almost out of focus. She sits upright, panting. "Sorry, I..." "That really hurt! Jesus!"
May, don't stop. I'm sorry. I was just so into it. I was so turned on. What is it exactly about beating me that turns you on?
Nothing. I'm sorry. Can we just...
I kiss her and work on rebuilding the rhythm. She shakes off the anger as best she can and makes a genuine effort to relocate our momentum. She has stopped with the verbal aggression. We coast to a finish. I have no confidence that her climax is real, and mine is disappointingly ordinary. It is only a little later, lying in bed on top of my sheets, naked and sticky, that we both laugh about what we agree to think of as my spasm or seizure brought on by erotic overload. I am relieved that I may not have fucked things up after all.
Hey, I say with an unconvincing air of casual indifference, Mom's having a party for Tilly tomorrow. You know, she was nominated for Peppermint Grove.
Ugh, I hated that movie.
Really?
She was okay, I guess, but the movie really sucked. I didn't buy the relationship. In real life, she never would have slept with him. I mean, he's like, what, 100 years older than her?
Although, I guess we were talking about your sister.
I take a breath and wait for the feeling to pass. I'm angry for my sister, who, by any measure, probably deserves comments like that. But it still gets to me. I let it pass.
So, you want to go?
Oh, David. She rolls over, turning her perfect, now welted ass in my direction, burying her face in the pillow. Eventually, she sits up. No, okay? This was really nice. I mean, aside from being beaten, I really enjoyed seeing you. But I just...
Why not?
I fight to sound indifferent and merely curious. Because I don't know what... She gestures at the tangle of sheets with a wad of tissue. All this means yet. And because... I don't know. Because I think your sister is a stuck-up little skank, and to be perfectly honest, your mom really gets on my nerves. She, like, really needs to relax. Your dad's great. He's so funny and sweet and attentive and knowledgeable and just so totally unlike the women in your family. But...
Tilly's not coming, I say, hopefully.
She's not?
Nope.
Then how... Speakerphone. You're kidding.
Mom's idea.
Yeah, I'm shocked. Like I said, Susan needs to take a pill. And...
What?
Nothing.
May.
Your brother.
What about him?
I don't know. He makes me a little uncomfortable. I'm just never good with, you know, the disabled. Does that make me awful? That makes me awful.
No, it doesn't make you awful. It's not a crime. Ben will probably spend most of the time in his room anyway.
I'm really not wild about the idea, Dave. Yeah, I get that. But why not just come by for a little bit? Say hello. You don't have to stay. You know, just...
I resist the urge to tell her that all she needs to do is bake a casserole.
Just make an appearance. Tell him you're feeling sick, but just wanted to say congratulations or something.
She sighs and holds her head in her hands, hair cascading in gorgeous black locks to her naked lap. I kiss her shoulder, unable to resist this manipulation, but not knowing why. The momentum of wanting her back can't be stopped.
Maybe. Go without me. If I'm there, I'm there. If I'm not there, then...
She doesn't finish. I know this is as close as I will ever get to a commitment. My heart swells with something that is either relief or dread. She slips off the bed and pads into the bathroom. I wonder whether Detective North is eating donuts and drinking bad coffee in a car parked 4 houses down the street. I try to imagine what he is thinking. The worry comes back in ferocious waves. I am simultaneously incredulous that I, David Johns, have these kinds of problems, and that I was almost able to forget about them for 15 minutes. The water stops. May lets out a defeated sigh as she pees. She speaks, I assume, more to herself than to me. I'm not telling anyone that I liked her stupid movie.